Reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, text 8. We'll continue from where we left off this morning. And these are the qualities that Krishna mentions are symptoms of knowledge. And these are only the first 9 in the first verse. Altogether, Krishna lists 20 such symptoms or qualities. And the other 11 appear in the next 4 verses. But of course, we don't have time to go into all of them. So what I will do is, I will just read the translation of all the 5 verses. So we get a picture, and then we'll talk of some of the qualities that have been listed here on the board and which we did not discuss this morning. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master, cleanliness, steadiness, self-control, renunciation of the objects of sense gratification, absence of false ego, the perception of the evil of birth, death, old age and disease, detachment, freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home and the rest, even-mindedness amid pleasant and unpleasant events, constant and unalloyed devotion to me, aspiring to live in a solitary place, detachment from the general mass of people, accepting the importance of self-realization, and philosophical search for the absolute truth. All these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. Quite strong. Krishna concludes and says, besides this, whatever there may be is ignorance. The purport is very long. So what we will do is, as and when we discuss a particular quality, I'll read that section of the purport and then we'll talk about it for a while. Om Ajnanati Virandasya Jnana Jana Shalakaya Chakshurun Meelitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kada Mahyam Kada Tispapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yutapada Kamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagata Lalita Shri Vishakhamitam Shri Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Peshtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Nitinamine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshutarine Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindhubhya evacha Patitanam pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So for those of you who didn't come this morning, very briefly, I'll recapitulate what we've discussed today. Humility, pridelessness and non-violence. Srila Prabhupada defines humility as, who remembers, some of those who came in the morning. Yes, you were in the morning, yeah?
Okay, 99%.
Humility means to not be anxious, to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. What a definition. Yes? Everyone likes to be honored by others. Who doesn't like to have his or her photograph come in a newspaper, become a famous person, and everybody saying, just see, such and such person has come. Honor, name, fame, these are all things that people of this world are very enamored by. And we're also attracted to people who are very famous, and we like to honor them as well. But a person situated in genuine knowledge is completely detached from such passion for honor and fame and name. That's very, very difficult indeed. One may conquer the baser passions of the body and mind, but the ego remains very strong and needs gratification, demands gratification. Therefore, the next point after humility, which is connected to the first one, is pridelessness. Because the ego can manifest even for a person on the religious path. One may become proud of one's religiosity. One may try to achieve positions and status within the society of religious people. And that's something that we as aspiring spiritualists have to be very cautious about. We don't seek any position even within the society of devotees. All we want is that we are servants of the devotees. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's conclusion. Gopi bhartu padakamalayo dasa dasanu dasaha. The principle that I am the servant of the servant of the servant of the master of the gopis. In other words, a servant of Krishna and Krishna's devotees. And the third one is non-violence. Does anyone remember what Srila Prabhupada defined non-violence as? Anyone in the morning? Who was there in the morning today?
Yes. A society that doesn't want to harm living entities.
Okay. That was a preliminary foundational definition, right? That non-violence means to not kill animals, to kill other living entities. That's the rock bottom definition of non-violence. You can't go below that, then it's not non-violence. So that's good. That's necessary. So by that standard, today's civilization is very violent. Because practically most people in the world today eat meat. And they cause animals to be killed in large numbers. So today's society is a very violent society. Yes, and the other connotation which Prabhupada indicates? Yes. Non-violence means, interestingly, to preach Krishna consciousness to all living entities, to spread the word of Krishna. Why so?
The material existence and not cause harm there is certainly not violence, but actually to keep somebody in bondage of material illusion is actually ultimate violence. So you don't save the thoughts of a drowned man, you're saving the soul if you give them Krishna consciousness.
Okay, fine, wonderful. You get your Mahaprasada. Prabhupada explains that violence means to cause pain to others. And this material existence is full of pain. That's what this material life is all about. There's no happiness here. There is no real joy here. So the more we assist somebody in perpetuating this cycle of birth and death, which is a source of misery, the more we are actually directly or indirectly inflicting violence upon that person. Conversely, if we preach Krishna consciousness, if we induce others to come to this path of Krishna consciousness, then we are actually enabling that person to make a permanent solution to suffering and misery once and for all. So then Srila Prabhupada says, non-violence really speaking means to spread the message of Krishna consciousness everywhere. And I'll just repeat that part of the quote. So unless one elevates people to spiritual knowledge, one is practicing violence. Strong one. Yes? So if you take that definition, there's even more violence in the world. If you take a look at just the killing of animals, that's just one part of it. That's massive anyway. But if you take the larger and deeper definition that Srila Prabhupada is giving here, then most of the world today massively is involved in violence. Then Prabhupada continues, one should try his best to distribute real knowledge to the people so that they may become enlightened and leave this material entanglement. That is non-violence. So these are the three qualities that we talked about this morning. The fourth quality is tolerance. Shantihi, different as I mentioned from Shanti. Shantihi means peace. Kshanti with a K before, that is tolerance. And let's see how Prabhupada defines tolerance. Each of these are very concise, eloquent definitions of each of these qualities. Yes, like humility, non-violence. Very succinct. And that's what eloquence is about, right? Eloquence is truth spoken concisely. Am I right? That's the definition of eloquence. So the great acharyas like Srila Prabhupada are so eloquent. They can speak truth so concisely. So let's hear Prabhupada's definition of tolerance. Quote, tolerance means that one should be practiced to bear insult and dishonor from others. Ouch. That hurts. Yes? Continue. If one is entangled in the advancement of spiritual knowledge, there will be so many insults and much dishonor from others. This is expected because material nature is so constituted. Even a boy like Prahlad, who was only 5 years old, was engaged in the cultivation of spiritual knowledge, was endangered when his father became antagonistic to his devotion. The father tried to kill him in so many ways, but Prahlad tolerated him. So there may be many impediments to making advancement in spiritual knowledge, but we should be tolerant and continue our progress with determination. And remember, what are we discussing? What's the topic going on here? Symptoms of knowledge. So if someone is a PhD, if someone has all sorts of Nobel Prizes and this prize and that prize, but doesn't have these qualities, we do not, by Krishna's standard of definition, consider that person to be situated in knowledge. The world may have one definition of knowledge, a different conception of it. But we go by Krishna's definition. That knowledge is not just a question of some theoretical book knowledge, speculative knowledge. It's not a question of being proud and puffed up with some accumulation of data and information about this world. It's not a question of having a high IQ and a charismatic personality to bewilder others with word jugglery. It's a question of cultivating these qualities. Humility, pridelessness, non-violence, tolerance. So we can understand that being situated in knowledge then is not a small thing, not an easy thing. It's not just a question of going to a school or a university, getting a degree and thinking, now I'm situated in knowledge. Krishna gives a completely different paradigm shift to our understanding of what knowledge is all about. So tolerance then, again, I'll repeat, one should be practiced to bear insult and dishonor from others. Why? Why? Why is that important for our spiritual life? Why is it important for a person situated in knowledge to bear to insult and dishonor from others? Anyone?
Because that makes us angry, and when we are angry, we are not like, we get violent. We are again very far from God when we are angry.
Wonderful. I think another second Mahaprasad, someone giving back some special sweet. Excellent. What happens when somebody speaks harshly to you, or dishonors you, or speaks very disparagingly about you? What do you feel? Do you feel blissful? No. When someone praises us, oh, that's like a stream of nectar. And the person seems to be someone who is, let's say, wrongfully denied of the Nobel Prize or something. This person is so intelligent. But when someone criticizes us or humiliates us, then that's really painful. It hurts like anything. And the more you meditate on that, the more you think about it, what do you feel like doing? You get angry, you get all upset and worked up. And then you want to get even with that person, isn't it? You want to get, you're just waiting for a chance when you can get even. Maybe give back capital and interest. And you're waiting, a time will come, and sometimes people remember these things for years, decades. They remember, oh, this person said this to me, or did this to me years ago. And then it happens so many times. And they don't let go. You see, unless you let go of the material world, you can't obtain the spiritual world. So we have to learn to let go. Even keeping aside spirituality, even if you want to be peaceful in material life, of course that's not possible, but even relatively so, you have to learn to let go. Can I request you to please switch off your mobile phone? Yes? At least in the class. Okay? In Vrindavan, I would fine everybody 500 rupees for the mobile phone. And one time our temple was short of money and I used that as a fundraising strategy. It collected quite a lot of money. So, where was I? So when somebody speaks harshly to us, we remember it for a long, long time. We don't forget it. It's so painful. And the fact that we don't like criticism is one of our weaknesses. We can't tolerate criticism. There was one man, a little story I'll tell you, and he was a sculptor by profession, very good sculptor. And he was also a great astrologer. So he found out the exact moment of his death. Now you can predict if you're a really, really good astrologer. Which day, which date, what time. So he had it all worked out. So he said, okay, the god of death, Yamaraj, is going to come to take away my soul and I'm going to trick him. So I'll pull a fast one on him. I'll make sure that he can't take me away. That he'll go back, he'll come, but he'll go back perplexed. So what did he do? He made images of himself, statues of himself. And he was a great sculptor, so every one of those statues was a perfect likeness of him. And he was in his pose, you know, the thinking man's pose, yes? So he had these 25, sculptures, all looking like him, perfectly. Every little facial feature and so on. And when the time came, then he had measured, so Yamaraj is going to come any time. So that he also sat down and sat in that pose. And the Yamaraj came, the god of death, because this is appointed duty to take away a person's soul when the time comes to die. So he arrived and he looked around and was bewildered. He said, what's going on here? Who is the candidate which I'm supposed to take away? They all look the same. But Yamaraj is also very intelligent. Otherwise, you don't get there until you're very intelligent. You can't be a great demigod unless you're really brilliant. So Yamaraj said, so this one is, he's trying to play a trick on me. All right. I also have some tricks up my sleeve. So he looked at all the statues and then he started speaking aloud as if speaking to himself. Oh, what a terrible sculptor. He doesn't know how to make one statue. Look at these mistakes, look at this and look at that. And that was more than this man could tolerate. What do you mean? He stood up. All right, now come. Took it. That's how he was identified. Because that's our weak spot. You want to get at somebody's weak spot, criticize the person. That's it, and you know the true nature of the person. So generally we tend to be very harsh with people, and we neglect them at the very least, for people who are speaking harshly to us. You know, in this nature, in this world, human beings are surprisingly selfish and self-centered. We like people who praise us, and we hate people who criticize us. Even though sometimes those who criticize us may be our best friends. And that's how a devotee sees it. A devotee doesn't see one who criticizes him as his enemy. There's a little story that comes to mind about Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. One time he was giving a series of public lectures in a hall, in an auditorium. It was very well attended. And the program, of course, naturally was a great success. But there was one man who was always creating a disturbance in the audience. At the end of the lecture, he would stand up, and in a very impudent kind of way, he would ask challenging questions to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Some of them were actually quite insulting. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur didn't get agitated at all. And he answered him in a most humble tone and peacefully. But his disciples, of course, were getting really angry. And they were thinking, there's something we must do, but they had been restrained by the spiritual master to act in a vigorous way. So they just held themselves back. And then the program concluded. After several days, one time, one of his disciples came into the monastery. And he seemed very happy. He said, I have some good news, very good news for everybody. And all the devotees gathered. So what's the good news? Come, come. Let's tell. I'll tell it in front of our spiritual master. So they all went to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And they said, Guru Maharaj, we have a lot of good news for you. So what happened? What's the good news? You know that person who used to cause a disturbance in your public lectures in that auditorium? He was always trying to find fault with you and challenge you, and which I just got a message that he died. What a relief. We are so happy about this. But when they saw the expression of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's face, they could understand it. Bhaktisiddhanta was actually sad. He said, how sorry I feel. I'm so sad this person has left this world. And they said, but Guru Maharaj, this man was criticizing you like anything. See, he was my friend because he was criticizing me. If you're always surrounded by people who praise us, then that's not actually good for us. It just nourishes our false ego, that's all. And false ego is not good for spiritual life. It's not good for peace of mind. But this man was showing me my position, that I'm such an insignificant person, so he's actually my good friend. Of course, that doesn't mean that we can do the same that man did, but it's an example of how a great devotee thinks and feels. A typical example of how he was tolerant. So when people criticize us, and we'll get ample time to practice that, every day we'll get opportunities. Because somebody or the other says something about us or does something to us, and we don't like it. Of course, we may also speak of the idea of injustice. That's another thing. It's a thin dividing line, it's a complex topic. To what degree should we tolerate injustice in the name of tolerance, and so on and so forth. We all have a right to protect ourselves, of course, when it comes to our right to survive in this world. But nevertheless, the principle of tolerance remains. There's one great saintly person who said, some very interesting things which come to mind right now. And I'll urge you to try to remember them. He said there are two things we should always remember in life, and there are two things we should always forget in life. The two things we should always remember are that bad things are said or done to others, and the good things others have done to us or said to us. These are the two things we should always remember. The two things we should always forget are the bad things or the bad words others have spoken to us, and we should always forget the good things that we have said to others or done to others. Too complicated? Two things to always remember. One, the bad things we've done to others, and the good things others have done to us. Always remember that. Be grateful for the good that others have done to us, and be repentant for the bad we have done to others. So we have to remember both these things. And the two things we should always forget is the good I have done to others. We don't blow our trumpet every time and remind the person 20 years later, you know, remember, I did this for you 20 years ago. No, we forget about it. Even if I did something good to somebody, forget about it. Don't remember it. But if somebody has done good to me, I always remember it. The rest of my life I remember. Yes, you know, this person did good to me. Even if it was a small act of kindness, he did something good to me many, many years ago. Say two things to remember, two things to forget. Anyone wants to have a go at it? What are the two things you'd like to remember?
The bad things you've said or done to others.
Sorry?
The bad things that you've done or said to others.
The bad things that we've done or said to others.
And then the good things that they have done to you.
And the good things that others have done to us. We'd like to remember these two things, right? Okay, excellent. And what are the two things we'd like to, we should forget?
The good things we've done for others.
The good things we've done to others.
The bad things that people have said or done to us.
The bad things that people have said or done to us. Excellent. Simple formula. Difficult to do. But then, a person is known by the aspiration and standard he or she seeks in life. It doesn't matter really whether things are difficult to do or not. That's not the criterion by which we decide whether something should be done or not done. The deciding criterion is it the right thing to do? And is it the good thing to do? If it's right for me to do that, if it's good for me to do that, I should do it, regardless of whether it's easy or difficult. And if it's a wrong thing for me to do, then I should not do it, even if it's very easy. So yes, it's not easy to tolerate, especially if somebody says something to us. But we have to practice the art of tolerance. If this were not to happen, relationships would not exist in this world. Because in relationships always, whatever be the relationship, there's always a little this and that. So we take things in our stride. The word kshanti is also related to kshama, which means forgiveness. If you tolerate, you're willing to forgive. And what is life without forgiveness? Can you imagine a world where there was no forgiveness? There'd be total devastation. The feeling of revenge. He did this to me, so I'm going to return the favor. A tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye. Yes? That's a slogan, isn't it? A tooth for a tooth and an eye for an eye. And somebody said, he made an interesting comment. I think it was Mahatma Gandhi, if I'm not mistaken. He said, if we adopt the policy of an eye for an eye, then the whole world will be blind. That's a fact. So we're not willing to tolerate, and we always want to seek revenge for the wrongs that others have said to us or done to us, we're going to end up in a world where nobody can see anything. It's a lose-lose situation. So rather than worrying about harming others, let's think about positively about helping them and appreciating that they're helping us to be humble. But the materialistic mentality seeks to pull down others, regardless of whether I also lose in the bargain. That's called the lose-lose situation. There is a little story about how a man was carrying crabs to sell. So he put them in an open basket and he was taking them to the marketplace to sell. Now generally when he would capture other living entities, he would cover the basket. But in this case he didn't cover the basket and he would never do that. And he never lost a single crab. You know why? Yes.
So the crabs keep pulling the crabs back in.
Yes, that's right. Let's say there were 10 crabs in the basket. And they were all perfectly healthy. Now, they know that they are trapped in the basket, but they can easily crawl out. But the moment one crab tries to crawl out, the other crabs pull him down. No, you can't escape. And then the second one tries to escape, the others who are remaining, they try to pull him down. And they're all vigilant, not to ensure their own escape, which is easily possible, but they're vigilant to ensure that nobody else escapes. If they wanted to, they could have each have just crawled out of the basket individually and they'd all be free. But they don't want to do that. They want to ensure that the other one doesn't escape. So this is what happens when we can't tolerate and then we want to have a spirit of harming others, we want revenge. His Holiness Sachinandan Maharaj was saying one time that he knew somebody in Germany who went through a divorce and there was a very bitter separation between him and his wife and they began to hate each other. Because they must have hurt each other very badly. So they couldn't forgive each other. They couldn't tolerate the pain that each had caused the other. And when the time came for divorce, they had to settle their financial things. And this man was very wealthy. He had a lot of assets. So naturally the court said 50% goes to your wife. So 50% was, he had a huge house worth millions of Deutschmarks. So out of her desire to spite his ex-wife, what he did was he sold that house, which was worth millions, for 50 Deutschmarks. And then he gave 25 Deutschmarks to her. Right? He didn't mind that he lost out millions, but he wanted to ensure that she wouldn't get millions. So she ended up getting 25 and he also ended up getting 25. This is the nature of this world, yes? Well, we can't tolerate, we can't forgive, and we only look for vengeance, for revenge, for harming others. What a miserable state of consciousness it is. You know, when you envy others, when you hate others, when you can't forgive others, when you can't tolerate, the person who suffers more than anyone else is the person who harbors these sentiments. We may be envious of somebody, that person may be blissfully unaware that we are envious of him or her, but we suffer. So therefore tolerance is such an important thing for us. The example of Prahlad is given here by Srila Prabhupada. He underwent severe physical torture by his own father, something that's unthinkable. How can a father torture a little child who's only 5 years old? And why? Because Prahlad was a great devotee and Hiranyakashipu was a great demon. And Hiranyakashipu couldn't tolerate it that his son had some different opinion. That his son had become a devotee and was not following him. So he began to torture him in different ways. So on one hand, Hiranyakashipu, the father, could not tolerate his son's taking to a path of devotion. And on the other hand, Prahlad, was so tolerant, even when the time came for Lord Narasimha to appear and kill Hiranyakashipu, and Lord Narasimha asked him for a benediction, Prahlad. Prahlad says, I don't want anything. When the Lord insisted, he prayed, among other things, that his father should be delivered. Please be kind upon my father. This is the nature of a devotee. He doesn't bear ill will towards anyone. Even Jesus, for example, he tolerated all the persecution, you know, that he underwent. And even when he was crucified, what was the thing he said? Forgive them, for they do not know what they do, right? Something like that. So this is the spirit. Prabhupada used to often mention this example of Prahlad, of Haridas Thakur, of Jesus Christ. There's an example of tolerance and forgiveness. Then the next quality is simplicity. Let's see the beautiful definition of simplicity that Srila Prabhupada gives. Quote, simplicity means that without diplomacy, one should be so straightforward that he can disclose the real truth even to an enemy. Wow. Yes? We don't even disclose things to our own friends. What to speak of disclosing things to an enemy? So that's just one line. That one line, he said, I read that again. Simplicity means that without diplomacy, one should be so straightforward that he can disclose the real truth even to an enemy. So simplicity means that we should be childlike, not childish. There's a difference between being childish and childlike. Childish means immature, but childlike means that we are pure-hearted, we are simple, we are straightforward. Again, straightforwardness doesn't mean being rude or brash. Sometimes some devotees, I know they're very harsh, and then people complain. One time I asked a devotee, you shouldn't be so harsh with people. Devotees are complaining about you, that you speak very harshly. He said, I'm straightforward. I said, that's not what straightforward means. Straightforward doesn't mean you should be insensitive, that you should be unnecessarily harsh and rude to others. But it does mean that you shouldn't be duplicitous. Duplicitous means that you say one thing, but you mean another thing, and you do yet another thing. That's duplicitous behavior, where there's a disparity between what we think and what and how we act. But devotees are generally straightforward. They are honest. They have no pretensions. They're very, as they say, down to earth. Very simple. They live simply. They think simply. Think simply in the sense, not in a complicated way, but their thinking is high in the sense that they think of spiritual subjects. But in terms of ordinary, the complicated way in which people think in this world, they don't think like that. Very simple. And Prahlad was also very simple. Very simple-hearted. Of course, in this day and in this world, one cannot be naive. If one is naive, so being simple also doesn't mean being naive. If you're naive, then you get exploited by the world. And people will walk all over you. Many times people ask this question. You know, well, we talk of humility, we talk of tolerance and simplicity, but if we try to admire these qualities, in the modern day world, people will just swallow us and they'll exploit us. And indeed, that does happen. It's a harsh world we live in. But people are looking, materialistic people are looking for opportunities to exploit others. So what should we do? On one hand, we are told to cultivate these qualities that seem practically impossible for us to have. But we are at least expected to strive for them. And on the other hand, then we are faced with the prospect of being exploited by people in the world. So what do we do? That again reminds me of a little pastime of Narad Muni, the great devotee. You know, he's such an expert preacher, he makes disciples everywhere, in all species of life. So one time he had a snake who became his disciple. And the snake became a devotee. And that's something unusual, because a snake is considered to be the crest jewel amongst all envious living entities. Usually, animals or human beings, they become envious with somebody for some reason. But snakes can be envious for no reason. So therefore snakes are particularly dangerous. Of course, some human beings are more dangerous than snakes. But anyhow, it was a miracle of the potency of Narad Muni that the snake became a devotee. And it was a poisonous snake who had previously been biting or stinging people, and they used to die. So heavy was his poison. But once he was initiated by Narad Muni, then he decided to not do all this. So after a while, when Narad Muni was coming back, and he happened to see the snake, and then he was astonished to see that the snake was black and blue all over. His body was filled with bruises, and he was shocked. He said, "What happened, my dear disciple? You know, you look battered all over. What's happened to you?" So he said, "Well, ever since I became your disciple, I became a devotee of Krishna. You told me not to bite anyone. So I haven't bitten anyone, and as a result of that, they're beating me black and blue. So people are making fun of me. All the villagers come with sticks and stones and they beat me." So the Narad Muni said, "Look, I asked you not to bite, but I didn't ask you not to hiss. You get the point? So you have a right to hiss to protect yourself, but you needn't bite. So whatever you need to do to protect yourself, you do. In fact, our body is, our wealth is also the property of Krishna, so we have a right to protect it. And let's say you have a family. And if there's someone who is an aggressor towards your family or house, you have every right to protect yourself and your family. So we should do that. In fact, that's our duty. And then the rest we leave to Krishna. So yes, we try to be as simple as we can, as simple-hearted as we can, but not naive. So that's something that we see in the lives of the great acharyas like Rupa Goswami, Jiva Goswami, Sanatana Goswami. They were really very, very intelligent materially and spiritually. They were also very worldly wise. They understood how to deal with the world as a spiritual person. And they exhibited all humility when the need was to be humble, and they were very strong when the need came to become strong. Vajradapi kathorani kusumadapi komalam. There's a proverb, sometimes Prabhupada used to quote that a saintly person, a devotee, is sometimes stronger than a thunderbolt and sometimes softer than a flower. So depending on the situation, a devotee's behavior externally will have to be different. But internally, the devotee always cultivates these qualities. Take the example of Arjuna fighting the battle of Kurukshetra. Was Arjuna being humble at that time? What do you think? When Arjuna was fighting the battle, he was fierce on the battlefield. He was a terror. He was such a powerful warrior, he was just killing soldiers by the dozens and dozens and hundreds every day. And that's not the run-of-the-mill conception of humility. But Arjuna was being humble, even though he was very fierce. Why? Because he surrendered himself to the instructions of Krishna. Arjuna didn't want to fight the battle. But Krishna says, "For my sake you fight." So he gave up his own ego, he gave up his own individual desires, his own sense of independence, and submitted himself to Krishna's orders. "All right, Krishna, whatever you say, I will do that." So humility is not merely an external show of submission. That, of course, is generally to be done. We must follow that as well. But on occasion, humility may imply doing something that externally doesn't appear like that. It's more an internal cultivation of submission to the Lord and His devotees. So Arjuna was actually being humble because he was following the Lord's instruction. On the other hand, someone may claim to be very humble, but may not be actually humble. There is a story of Raghunath Bhatta Goswami, who was going from Varanasi to Jagannath Puri to see Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And this round, and when Raghunath Bhatta was traveling, he was accompanied, a devotee met him, Lord Ram, whose name was Ram Das. And this Ram Das was always chanting the names of Lord Ram, non-stop. And he was also very humble in his demeanor. He would carry Raghunath Bhatta's luggage, and he would serve him in every way. And so much so that Raghunath Bhatta became very embarrassed. He said, no, don't do this to me. Don't serve me like this. And the journey went on, and they finally reached Jagannath Puri. They came in front of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu saw Raghunath Bhatta and Ram Das. He welcomed Raghunath Bhatta, embraced him, but he completely ignored Ram Das. It was quite visible, quite obvious, that this was a deliberate snub. And Raghunath Bhatta, after some time, privately came back to Mahaprabhu and said, "Mahaprabhu, this gentleman I came with was such a nice devotee. He was chanting the names of Lord Ram all the time, and he was so humble. So why did you not give him your mercy?" So Mahaprabhu said, because he's Krishna, he's in the heart of everyone, so he understands everyone's thinking. He said, "Actually, latently, this person is an impersonalist. He wants to become God. So he's chanting the name of Ram, but not as a devotee. When a devotee chants the names of the Supreme Lord, he or she does so with the idea of being an eternal servant of God. But this person is chanting the name of Ram with the idea to become Ram." There are some philosophies that actually advocate that we should become God. So he said, because he is actually aspiring for becoming God, greater than the greatest, so therefore, how can he be a genuine devotee? So only externally he had symptoms of humility. He was trying to serve, but internally he harbored the most unhumble thing to do, to want to become God himself. So that's not simplicity, that's not humility. In terms of our lifestyle also, it's important to simplify our way of living. There was a very nice article by Satsvarup Maharaj one time, many years ago, in Back to God, and I still remember it. And the article was, simplify, simplify, simplify. Simplify your way of living. Cut down on the things that you think you need in life. Let's take some practical tips. Every time you want to buy something, ask yourself, do I really need it? Then if you say no, that settles the issue. But if the answer is yes, ask yourself again, do I really need it? If the answer is no, the problem solved. If the answer is still yes, ask yourself, do I really need it? And if it's still a yes, then go ahead. So today, life has not become simple at all. Life is very complicated. This consumerist culture, this super mall culture. The other day I had to purchase something late night, something urgently. And we were coming back from a program and they took me to this hypermarket in London. 24 hours open. So tantalizing, mesmerizing. You can't come away from the shopping mall without buying something. For sure. Everything is displayed in such a way. the sheer variety of it, mind numbing. You go there and say, oh, this is really nice. But there's so many varieties of that. First of all, you get totally confused. You don't know which one to take. Then you spend so much time deciding which of these competing products are the best. And you end up filling up your cart and then taking it away, even though you didn't want to. Modern business, or modern marketing as they call it, one of the sacred principles is to make you buy things that are not necessary for you, that you don't really need. That's the skill of a good advertiser or a marketing person, to make you buy things you don't need and convince you that you really need it when you don't. Prabhupada called it the unnecessary necessities of life. Yeah? Prabhupada was quite witty sometimes, very often actually. Unnecessary necessities, meaning that we think they are necessities but they are not. So we have to separate the wheat from the chaff. And we have to see, are these really necessary for me in my life? Do I really have to go for the shopping mall culture, consumerist culture, where I just accumulate more and more things? So living life simply, simplicity also means that we minimize our requirements. Live simply. Don't unnecessarily strive for more and more and more. And then the question arises, one time somebody asked, how much is enough? You say you shouldn't strive for it, you know, a lot. Be satisfied with something that's enough for you. But how much is enough? Now you can talk of this in many planes. But the simplest answer that I could give is, whatever you have now is enough. Period. That settles all arguments. Otherwise, you say, well, if you quantify, you say, well, this much and that much, and well, that much and this one has that. So many arguments you could give. But if you just say, well, whatever you have now is enough, and then let the rest remain in destiny's hands. If it comes, it comes. If it doesn't come, it doesn't come. So simplicity in terms of also our lifestyle, the kind of goods we use, the kind of things we aspire for. Keep things very, very simple and spiritual life will become so much easier. Our expenses will go down so much. Mentally we'll become so much more peaceful because we have less to worry about now. So simplicity in heart, simplicity in character, simplicity in relationships, simplicity in terms of the goods and services that we think we really need. So that is knowledge. Knowledge doesn't mean we go on acquiring things. So I think we've gone way beyond time. I think I'll stop now. Somehow, okay, where were we? Kshantir Arjava, simplicity. So maybe the next time somebody gives class, you can do the other ones. The other symptoms of knowledge. So I think we'll halt here. Thank you very much for coming to this program. And I leave some time for comments or questions. Kurma Prabhu, would you like to offer any comments?
I have a question about simplicity.
Right.
And when you mentioned Prabhupada's example of disclosing your mind to your enemies,
right.
I half remembered a story, which I'm sure you're familiar with, about a man who had a vow that he would never tell a lie, and he was living in the forest. And one day, he harbored a man who was running from some
police.
Was it the police or some bandits?
Dacoits.
So they were chasing
him. Yes, that's right.
And can you remember that story? Yes. And can you relate how that would be a wrong utilization of this simplicity about disclosing your mind?
Yes, actually, that's a story from the Mahabharata.
Right.
I need to give a little background. Anyway, it'll get too long to give the background, so I'll just narrate the story.
Yes.
The story is that there was a sage called Kaushik. And he had taken a vow that he would never speak a lie. So one time as he was sitting in his ashram, a man came running and he was being chased by some dacoits who wanted to kill him. And he ran away in one direction to save his life. And the dacoits came to the sage. They knew that the sage had taken a vow that he would never lie. So they asked him, please tell us where this man has, which way this man went. So Kaushik thought for a moment. Here was a dilemma. What should he do? If he were to stick to his vow, then the man would be killed by the dacoits. And if he were to try to save the other person's life, he would have to break his vow. So either way, there would be a problem. So then Kaushik decided that he would keep his vow. So he spoke the truth and said, yes, I saw that person and he went that way. And the dacoits chased him and they probably killed him. So the question came up, what Kaushik did, was it right or wrong? Now Krishna said it was wrong. And this topic came up incidentally. You know, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, the time when Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur and later Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur were in the intellectual elites of Calcutta. They would gather for debates and so on. And there were many such people who gathered there, top intellectuals of that place. But they were all so anglicized and deracinated from, you know, the traditional culture. But still they would gather and discuss. So in this gathering one time was a poet, intellectual, called Bankim Chandra Chatterjee. Bankim Chandra is the name of Krishna, but he wasn't a devotee of Krishna. And there was also the Nobel laureate in literature called Rabindranath Tagore. Right? And somehow they happened to be discussing this pastime. And the discussion was, was Kaushik right in doing what he did? Bankim Chandra and some others said no. He should have saved that person's life. He should have spoken a lie. Because there was a higher issue at stake. And Rabindranath Tagore said no. One should never speak a lie. So then when he was asked, well then does it mean that he should sacrifice the other person's life? He said no, he should have just have said, I will not tell you. So Bankim Chandra said to him, respond, well, how practical is that? Then you have to lose your life. And he says that. Anyway, that discussion went on. So this was the story then. So Krishna actually said, no, Kaushik should have saved that person's life. Because in this world, there's always a question of doing one thing, sacrificing one thing for the purpose of a higher thing. So sometimes you may give up one principle of virtue for achieving a higher principle of virtue. Now, saving a person's life is more important than just sticking to your vow of speaking the truth. If by you speaking a lie you save somebody's life, then that's better. Because the principle of saving the life is a higher principle. So Krishna was explaining this story to Arjuna and Yudhishthira. When Arjuna stepped into the room when Yudhishthira was alone with Draupadi and they had taken a vow that for 1 year at a time one of the brothers would be with Draupadi and the other would not come in. And if he happened to come in, then he'd have to go out for 12 years as a punishment. And the circumstances were such that a brahmana came and he was in great distress. And Arjuna was duty-bound to assist him and his bow and arrow were in the room. So he entered in, he broke the rules. And then Arjuna said, I've broken the rule. After he dealt with the aggressors and all that, then he came back and said, well, I've broken the rule, I'll go away for 12 years. So then Yudhishthira said, no, no, but you went because you had to save the brahmana's life. So, you know, you did it for a higher purpose. But Arjuna said, no, I've broken the rule, that's it. So I must go in exile for 12 years. And then Krishna was asked, and then Krishna narrated this story. And said, no, Arjuna, actually you need not go, because even though you did break a rule, you did break your vow, but there was a higher principle at stake that was saving the life and the property and the family of the Brahmana. You did it for that reason, not for any other reason. But Arjuna was adamant. He went anyway for his 12 years in exile. So that was the context in which his whole story was saying. It's an interesting story. Actually, one time in India, I went to a law school, which is considered the best law school in India, in Bangalore. And they asked me to speak on ethics. And I narrated this story many years ago. And I said how ethics is such a tricky topic, because you're always confronted with dilemmas, ethical dilemmas. To do this or to do that. Dharma, the ways of dharma are very intricate and very puzzling, very complex. It takes a very deep understanding of virtue and dharma to be able to decide what's the right thing to do at any given point in time. Because principles of virtue may sometimes conflict with each other. You have to decide which is higher. And then you have to do that which is higher. So therefore, even the kings in the old days, in the Vedic culture, had a council of brahmanas who would guide the king on what the dharmic thing was to do in a particular situation. They would deliberate amongst themselves, and often even they couldn't come to a conclusion, because circumstances in this world can be very, very complicated. But anyway, they would advise the king, so according to the laws of dharma, my dear king, this is what you should be doing. But today we don't have anything like that. We run on totally secular laws, or vox populi, yes? Whatever people say, that goes. So I believe here also there's been a lot of upheaval in Ireland, and people are saying, well, we want to, you know, dispense with our tradition, we want to just be more and more liberal, and we'll do whatever we feel is right, freedom of expression, you know, free will, free choice. So the vox populi decides. The voice of the majority decides what laws will be passed in the government. That's not necessarily the best. Because the people who clamor for a certain kind of change to be instituted may not be the ones, or usually are not the ones who are situated in knowledge. They're the ones who are just swayed by some kind of ignorance, a particular type of ignorance. And that's propagated as being liberal and as being enlightened. So therefore this kind of liberalism today is taking the world in a very wrong direction. I was mentioning today, this morning, that actually there are two kinds of extremism in the world now, among others. One is religious extremism, which is causing terrible harm to the world, and we're seeing that happening. And the other is liberal extremism. The liberals are also becoming equally extreme, and both the extremes feed on each other, and they create havoc in the world. And there's a clash of both these worlds, the liberal extremes and the religious extremes, and they fight with each other. So for us, we tread the moderate, simple path as devotees of Krishna. We don't want to get into extremes. We want to tread Krishna's path, which is a path of love. But of course, we do hold strong views, certainly. But our whole process is to enlighten people by knowledge. Not by force, not by aggression, by gentle persuasion. We talk logically, we establish the principles of Krishna consciousness, make it appealing to everybody. And then gradually we have to win over people's hearts by our sincerity, by love, by proper philosophy, by proper presentation of the knowledge. Then the world can be transformed. Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One question.
Yes.
would that be an origin of the expression?
Sorry?
To commit the story you mentioned, where he had to either tell a lie or not tell a lie. Is that the white lie? You know, people
the white lie.
Yeah, where is that the origin of it?
Well, it's always been around.
Yes.
You know, not telling a lie is not an absolute principle. Sometimes it's good to tell a lie.
Yeah. So that would be a call.
But it depends. You know, we can't use this principle whimsically. In general, we must tell the truth. But let's say you go to somebody's house, right? And there's this person who's prepared a nice meal for you with a lot of devotion. And then there's some meal, there's something gone wrong with something. She asks you, how's the meal? Oh, it's nice. And, oh, it's terrible. I'm straightforward. I want to be straightforward. You know why? You want to make her happy. Say, yeah, it's nice. You do it all the time, isn't it? The little lies we say all the time. It's not a big sin or something like that. Because your intention is you want to keep people happy, not in ignorance. And that's a different thing. So the principle of speaking the truth is definitely valid. It's something we should be very concerned about. At the same time, it's not an absolute principle, unless it's connected to Krishna, who is the absolute truth. So even when Krishna speaks a lie, it's the truth, because he's the absolute truth speaking. But we can't take shelter of that principle and be whimsical in our day-to-day life and think that I'm a devotee, therefore I can just lie whenever I like. That would be very dangerous. It's not the right thing to do. Right? Okay, yes.
Actually, if this is the true knowledge, why do we seek and try to learn other things? And why do we even wish to have a family? And why should we do that if can't we just seek this knowledge, which is the true one?
I also asked that question. Your question is, if this is what true knowledge is all about, why do we do so many other things in this world? Yes, we have indeed as a society complicated our life like anything. Yes, now we need to simplify things. No harm in getting a family, that's not a problem. Or in earning a livelihood, that's necessary. But we do things in a spirit of service to Krishna, in service to the world in Krishna consciousness. Not for the sake of sense gratification, for our ego and so on. Okay? Alright, so it's quite late. So we'll stop here. Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure for me to come here to Ireland and to be with all of you. And I hope and pray that the Irish Yatra will grow from strength to strength. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada ki Hare Krishna.